Institute's Global Conversation Series. Today, I'm delighted to be speaking with Ambika Vishwanath, the director of the Kubanayan Initiative in India. Ambika is a renowned expert on foreign policy, water security, and peace building with deep expertise across South Asia and beyond. My name is Janani Vivekananda. I am the Senior Research Fellow at the Toda Peace Institute, responsible for climate and conflict. And it's my honor to have this time with you to have a conversation. Really happy to have this chance to discuss, amongst other things, I think the value and practical potential of trilateral policy exchange, or just broader policy exchange on the topic of climate, peace and security, bringing in India, who to date has really not been part of this climate, peace and security discourse. So it would be great to get your thoughts on this. I mentioned trilateral because it would be interesting to bring India into the European and Asia Pacific discourse. And as well as that, to also unpack the geopolitical dimensions of climate, peace and security in the South and Southeast Asia region, as well as the Asia Pacific. So that's what I hope we will be able to cover, and probably a lot more. So Ambika, thank you so much for joining us, for making the time. And as you well know, climate security is increasingly intersecting with peace, security, cross-regional collaboration, multilateralism, across all these spaces. It's becoming even more important in foreign policy, but we do see it absent in kind of some of the foreign policy discourses, particularly in South Asia and in India, which is somewhat a missed opportunity or surprising, given that the Indo-Pacific faces very specific challenges, but also opportunities in the climate diplomacy space. So I'd like to start by exploring your perspectives on the way India can be brought in, or South Asia can be brought in more, and how, and maybe an understanding of what you see as India's role in the geopolitical landscape.
Thank you, Janani. It's great to be here in a discussion with you. So on your question, let me come at it from a couple of different angles, right? When we think of climate security or the security implications of climate change, they are usually linked to climate-related threats or security risks as we see them from a more traditional perspective, right? So whether that is on societies, whether that's on economy, whether we might talk about it from a migration perspective, we might talk about it from a resource degradation and then resource scarcity, and so then resource scrambling perspective, right? So it's come at it from a more like traditional aspect of how we might think of what security looks like from a long-term view. And in that sense, then I would say that the concept of climate, peace and security has been largely in that domain. Now, whether we link it to changes in the European sense or changes in Africa or in the Pacific, which is where I'm sitting right now in Australia, the angles that one might come at it is different. You know, in a lot of Africa or in Pacific, or the dominant discussion either is on food security or on migration and displacement, for example. In Europe, some of the dominant discussion is also on migration, but not so much on food security. It's more on things like, you know, rising heat, which is now in European cities. But there is always that underlying security angle to it. From the Indian perspective, the way the approach has been a little bit different, in that I would say the language is different, the lens is a little bit different, but actually the ultimate goal is not very different, right? For India, when we say climate and security, it's more in terms of looking at it from a long-term justice perspective, right? So climate justice, climate finance, you know, historical emissions. And so the conversation is around energy and renewable, and so security from that side of things. Also, water, food, gender, agriculture, urbanization, but all of that is seen more from a domestic lens. So when you say climate, peace and security in an Indian context, and it's seen more from a domestic lens perspective, how do we then look at it from our policies, whether they are at a state level, at a city level, and a municipal level, right? The goal, I would say, is ultimately the same. It is human and environmental security. How do these intersect? All of that is actually quite similar. It's just the language and the approach that we are taking is a little bit different. And I think that's where a lot of folks then see the disconnect in how a country like India and then others as well might perceive what climate peace and security is to what certain countries in like Europe or the Western audience might perceive what climate peace and security is. And so I think in that sense, then to answer your second question of engagement, the key here is understanding why this perspective and this approach is slightly different to be able to then merge them together going forward.
Thank you. I'm tempted to be a little provocative now. So I think that's a really helpful framing just to understand and really hammer home how climate security risks are different for different different regions, different national governments. And it's great that you reinforce this kind of understanding of climate justice and equitable access to renewable technology and this kind of thing as a core to India's understanding of climate security. But anywhere that I've been working on this policy around climate peace and security, even the countries where the research is being funded, is driven by national interest or regional security interests. So what would India's kind of pragmatic realpolitik interest in engaging in climate peace and security from a diplomatic perspective be, do you think?
So, I mean, I think you've sort of touched on it, right? It is from a national interest perspective. I think, especially in today's day and age, and right now, today it's what, as we record this, it's September 10th, and in Australia, and the dominant news is on what happened in Nepal yesterday, and what happened in Qatar, right? And so they're very different news perspectives, but as somebody who works on looking at long-term security, how do we build resilience for communities to avoid some of these kinds of conflicts, I think these are very important. That national interest then becomes a very core underlying factor, whether we would like to admit it or not. So even if from an Indian perspective, we want to say, you know, we don't link climate peace and security, if we are actually thinking about it from a justice perspective, from an equitable energy, we need more renewable energy because we have a population that requires energy for a number of different things. It comes down to that national interest, right? Now, the core national interest in developed economies will be different, obviously, but that doesn't mean our drivers are not somewhat similar. The challenge sometimes can be in recognizing that you can have different drivers, but they don't have to be the drivers that are at odds with each other. In that sense, I think the diplomacy angle then becomes really key, right? Can we, as developed economies who are engaging with developing economies, recognize that while drivers are different, we need to work with, you know, each other in that sense? And you can't do something without India right now based on like what India brings to the table on whether it is on tech or whether it is on skills. All of these become important components to your larger question of whether you're looking at it from a climate peace and security angle. And I would say vice versa. India might not like to frame it in a climate peace and security perspective. And so when you have developed economies wanting to discuss it from that angle, I think India also needs to recognize that there is some benefit from linking these things, because we might say, okay, no, this is not a securitized discussion. But if you look at South Asia as a region right now, there is a lot of securitization of these discussions, right? So we have to be cognizant and I think a little bit more pragmatic. Just one more thing on this, right? Understanding that there are these different drivers helps also create a more pragmatic approach to what diplomacy could be going forward. Because we're grappling right now with some of these questions when we say, rules-based order and global governance, and while it might have been a geopolitical discussion to talk about rules-based order and global governance even a few years down the line, right now these are all discussions that are merging. So recognizing that there is a need for some of these things to come together, I think is also important, and we don't do that well enough in South Asia.
I think those specific drivers, I see a lot of scope there for cooperation. I think so far we've been a little stymied by these being seen or understood or misunderstood as being barriers. But I think understanding these different drivers and these different unique perspectives and experiences that different contexts bring really give kind of different spaces for practical cooperation. If I bring it to quite a technical level, I'd say, I was just in South Korea last week, and there's very little conversation on climate, peace, and security. But the un like a real priority there when it comes to national interest and how this is affecting the national priorities is around air quality. And I think this is something similar in India and also in China that really has can move policy levers. And yet, this is not really something that is shaping climate policy or climate security policy in Europe or in Australia, where it's more around migration and mobility or around kind of the critical mineral scramble. It's just these different kind of different frames, I guess, which mean that there's more scope for sharing, and if there's more expertise in different spaces that others can bring to the table to kind of shape a more rounded dialogue. So on this, where do you see, in terms of kind of positive practical spaces for cooperation or joint action, where do you see the greatest potential for India? And if just to make it very concrete, say India with a European partner like Germany, and since you're in Australia, let's bring Australia into this.
I mean, I would say the potential is tremendous, right? Also because we've done so little. So then I think the playing field is quite large, and we can be excited about the fact that the potential in the relationships between an India and a Germany, or an India and an Australia, or if right now the one thing I'm super excited about is the potential, like, trilateral between these three countries, because there's so much that I would say that they have to offer that come really well together. One is on, if we say, look at the Indo-Pacific, for example, as an area of where things can be done. One is recognizing that while the Indo-Pacific is superbly vast, as we know, and geographically how we define the Indo-Pacific is also quite varied. German definition of it is different from Indian definition, geographic border wise, is different from Australian definition, geographic border wise, right? But I think if we not look at it from that side, but look at it actually from a climate science perspective, right? So, and that in that I would say, understand how the science is actually playing out in this region, and what does that mean in terms of when the science falls on, a country or on people. And what do I mean? So more practically, I'm saying things like understand how things like wind patterns, air current patterns, monsoon patterns, heat patterns, how are they changing in this region that everybody's now got a strategy around, but that strategy is still quite, like, I would say, narrow. But if we look at it from a, say, have a climate Indo-Pacific strategy, so we understand the movement of climate in this region and how it's then affecting the region in a cascading risk perspective, right? So what's happening in the Pacific Ocean, how does it translate to Southeast Asia, the water bodies over there, to how it translates to the Indian Ocean, and then what is the risks or what is arising out of that? I think just doing more joint research on something like this would be hugely beneficial to then all the security actors that are present in this entire region, right? Whether you want to increase your security presence from a maritime perspective, or whether you want to increase it from a trade route perspective, you want to have more economic engagement over here, all of that is going to be affected if you are not understanding the science behind it. And I say this in a very simple way, and I know it's much more complicated than this, but I say it simply because I do know that when we have, and I'm experiencing this now, right, when there are changing monsoon and weather patterns here in the Pacific region, in months down the line, they are going to affect Southeast Asia and then the Bay of Bengal and then the wider Indian Ocean, right? But we are not paying attention enough to some of these movements. So I would say more research, more joint research, because folks here obviously are looking at that and paying attention to that. And then folks in the Indian Ocean are paying attention to what's going on there, right? So can we bring more collaboration in that? And then more on the analysis. How do these things interplay with the what would be considered a more non-traditional aspect of security, right? How are they interplaying with like long-term food security, water security? How does that interplay then with human security? Then we'll better understand, I think, why we are seeing maybe changes in migration patterns of people, why there are changes in livelihood patterns, right? So collaboration, I would say, on understanding, on research, on analysis, and then development of joint strategy. There is a lot of that potential over there is tremendous.
I think that's a really good segue. I think the focusing on some of the scope for academic cooperation or science diplomacy as a very practical way of bringing India into a kind of policy exchange or knowledge exchange on climate, peace and security is a really viable and feasible one. I think it seems tangible in the current kind of geopolitical context that we're in. And your answer brought us very naturally to this point, to the kind of geopolitical dynamics of this and the scope for diplomatic engagement. And your second part of your answer about the policy, like translating this knowledge, this joint knowledge into policy to inform, you know, agriculture and energy policy. This is partly about national policy, but it's also about regional approaches, because of course you're mentioning regions, that you're mentioning the Indo-Pacific or the Bay of Bengal. Given that the region is a little bit light on functioning regional institutions, what role can the existing kind of formal or informal institutions play? What scope do you think there is? You know, there are other spaces like outside of the SARCs and the ASEANs, this Quad. There are some technical alliances, not just security alliances, things like BIMSTEC. Do you see those as having some scope and value, diplomatic value in amplifying India's contribution to this space?
I would say in a region, we are not light on the alphabet soup. There are several institutions.
I said functioning institutions.
Light on, yes, the functioning of those institutions. But you know, interestingly, at least in South Asia, with the BIMSTEC, with the BBIN, even with SAARC, now we have IORA, we have the CDRI, there is obviously...
May I just ask you, for our audience that might not be familiar with the alphabet soup, Ambika, can you just explain what some of these are?
Yeah. So the BBIN is the Bhutan, Bangladesh, India, Nepal. The IORA is the Indian Ocean Rim Association. You have the International Solar Alliance. Then there's an alliance on looking at the Coalition of Disaster Risk and Resilience. SAARC is, for all sense and purposes, a defunct organization of, I would say, 7 or 8 South Asian countries. I think the one positive takeaway from so many is that in some way or the other, each of these units, let's say, and each of these institutions have over time come up with some very innovative and interesting ideas. Now, some of them have not always been very successful from a long-term sustainability perspective because of politics, because of the histories of the region, and because of then geopolitical issues as well that countries are contending with. But those ideas, I would say, and some of those like programs do have a lot of potential to be then perhaps taken on in another sphere. And I specifically, I'll mention both the BBIN and the IORA. They have actually really interesting like scientific and academic exchange programs. They're not like as, I would say, robust as perhaps certain academic and exchange programs within other regions in the world, but they do exist, and they have produced some really innovative, very like fantastic, far-reaching reports and ideas and analysis between academic exchanges and like research and like long-term research exchanges between collaborators, both within the region but also with collaborators from outside of the region. And so it's always worth looking at some of these like little things that are happening. They're not like, super sexy in that sense, but they do add value to how we then think of like long-term like policy analysis, right? So I would say there is a number of those activities. Even the SAARC, for the fact that it is, it is defunct in many ways as an organization, though they do meet in some ways virtually, and they still have an open door exchange, I would say. There is some very interesting legal provisions within the SAARC on looking at joint disaster management programs, right? Worth looking at that and perhaps taking it into an institution that is more functioning than that is, right? Borrowing from some of those ideas. The point is here is not to say that we need to reinvent and come up with new ideas. A lot of these institutions have actually come up with some really very good concepts and programs and projects. They just, in some cases, either need to be taken out of of the home that isn't allowing them to flourish, and being put into other institutions. And I would say, in that sense, then the International Solar Alliance right now is a much more robust organization. It's much more global in nature. It's got a lot more resources in terms of finance and skills, in terms of tech resources, in terms of people. And countries are really committed to working with the alliance, right? So perhaps bringing some of the ideas into the Solar Alliance. And the interesting thing about the Solar Alliance is that while it is largely about solar alliance, about renewable energy going forward, it is in some areas taking a little bit more of a comprehensive approach, right? So how do we approach renewable energy along with ensuring like water security, for example, right? And that's I think some very unique projects over there that are happening.
But I feel like we can't talk about solar and the solar technology without then talking about the particular influence of China. And how can you say a few words about how the influence of China might shape India's approach to some of these issues, whether we call it climate peace and security? I have no particular desire to hold on to this terminology for this conversation. We can call it what we want to, but yeah, basically to how the influence of China shapes some of the regional geopolitical dynamics around spaces like solar.
I realized when I said solar, I was going to open this door, and I was trying to think of a way not to, but I think it's unavoidable, right? Whether we want to or not, now China comes into all of these discussions, and see, there's two ways I would say to look at it, and this is a very fascinating discussion in Australia right now that I've been reading about. Is one is, how do we constructively engage with China? And having spent years of working with folks, especially in Germany, but in other parts of Europe, it's the same discussion, right? You cannot ignore China. You cannot completely de-link. I think the Europeans, they tried to have a de-link strategy, and then they said, okay, we'll go on then to a de-risk strategy, because de-linking is just not an option, right? So either you constructively engage to the point where you say, okay, there is going to be a certain amount of give and take. It's not just take from your side. But you do recognize that, especially on the solar or other aspects of like renewables, other aspects of like critical minerals, whatever you might need for your tech development, most of that is in some way of shape or form going to come from China, right? Now, either you build your capacity to be able to wean yourself off of this dependency over time. You cannot do it overnight. Nobody's going to be able to fill that gap overnight. So you build capacity in other ways elsewhere, but you constructively engage with them as much as you need to, without completely, I would say, losing your sovereignty as much as that is feasible. Or the other side of the conversation is then you completely cut yourself off. And that's not realistic, right? That's not realistic from the perspective that in today, in 2025, we are an incredibly linked society globally on everything. You might think that, okay, I have stopped buying X product from China and I'm going to buy it from somewhere else. But the tiny components within that, you don't even realize where they're coming from, right? So I think the important part is one, being more pragmatic and recognizing what is the value of constructive engagement. And I see now countries are doing that. I've seen in the last 6, 8 months, you might have realized that India has now sort of, I would say, there is a slow thaw in that relationship. They're not going to be best friends, despite what the SCO summit pictures made it look like. But that having engagement is useful. They are, our largest neighbor. I see that kind of sort of pragmatism here in Australia as well, and I've seen it in we saw it when the European leaders visited and had engagements, phone calls and things like that with the Chinese leadership over the last year itself, right? So, but at that same time, we also on the climate side of it need to be really aware of how do we then build our capacities and whom do we build that with, right? And so I go back to one of your earlier questions on what is it that India and Australia and Germany and others can do together. And I think on the India-Australia side, we have skills, we have the tech, we don't necessarily have the manufacturing capabilities, but Germany has manufacturing capabilities. South Korea has manufacturing capabilities. Australia has minerals. Australia also has certain other capabilities. They don't have the skills. They don't have the manpower that we have in India. So there are a lot of benefits that each country is bringing. It also comes down to, can we take the risks to work a little bit more with each other? And say, all right, we're going to jump in and do this, as opposed to this like slow dance that these middle powers have been doing for years to say, yes, we are great friends, but it's still a slow dance.
On this, you mentioned a few examples already, but are there any specific kind of diplomatic approaches that should and could be better adopted by countries like Germany and Australia to engage India more constructively? You've already mentioned the importance of having a framing that resonates with the Indian political context. Are there any other particular things that you can think of that would be helpful diplomatic levers to build trust and really foster this cooperation?
I mean, I think between India and Germany, there is still quite a bit more that's been done in the last, I would say, even in the last like year, right? I've been looking at this relationship for maybe a little bit over a decade, and yeah, I've noticed a switch that has been happened maybe in the last like 2 to 3 years. And there was a question whether after the elections in Germany, what would that mean for this relationship? And I don't think that there's going to be too much change, right? That this current government in Germany will, from what I have seen, definitely take things forward. And I also would say, I think this current government in Germany would take things forward in a much faster sense. Now, this India-Germany relationship has been growing for a very long time, right? You know this, and I know this, and everybody knows this, and we're all waiting for it to finally grow up. And I think that's now finally we're there. Right? And so I don't think that trust is a is the problem so much. I mean, we will always have differences. Whether today it's a difference on how we deal with Ukraine and Russia, whether it's a difference on what, tech transfer actually looks like on IP and things like that. I don't think trust is really the question. I think the question is actually understanding what is it that we bring to the table and realistically, who is putting what in terms of resources. And that is where we need a little bit more knowledge of each other in that sense, right? There is an expectation, I know, for India to bring more to the table, and maybe not on a financial sense, but on the other ways, right? What do we bring? But on the skill side, on the tech side, on certain capabilities, can we do more? And I think we should. That expectation is not unfounded, I would say, whether it is coming from Germany or whether it's coming from Australia. We are a little bit hesitant sometimes, and I'd say to our own detriment, to actually take the first step, to take a leap, to be a little bit more risky. And I think we could do that. I would say on some levels, the Germans are also a little bit hesitant to be a little bit more risky. And as little bit risk-averse countries, we need to get over it, in that, and do more. And what does that more look like? It doesn't have to be like huge. It can also, I mean, huge is good, it's necessary, but it can also be small, right? And small could be, do we have enough knowledge of what India is doing from the bottom up, localized work on climate solutions, whether it is, women, various projects that we have across the country on it, in like indigenous knowledge that women hold in communities. Do we have that understanding in Germany? Do we have it in Australia? Can we learn it? Can we bring it to our communities elsewhere, right? Do we have enough knowledge on what small scale projects look like? Where can they be scaled up? Do we have enough knowledge on where exactly we want to direct our funding? And this becomes really important, right? For a long time, countries have come into India and said, "Oh, like this is the fund. This is how we think our funding should be directed." Can we listen more now to where India is saying the funding should be directed? And by here, I don't mean the government, but actually partners, local partners within the country. And I think some of those shifts are required for us to be able to, I think, move to the next step. But I would also say on the other side, India needs to recognize that there is certain value that, countries like Germany, Australia, and our other global partners around the world bring to us to be able to combat the number of, like, the multitude of risks that we are facing in the country right now, and that it's okay to one ask for help and be bring knowledge to the region to contextualize it. Everybody's waiting for the other person to make the first move.
No, that's I think that's what I wanted to ask you, but you've already answered some very, very practical suggestions in terms of paths forward, both for kind of a political dialogue and very core things for an exchange across these three countries, but also some great examples of sharing and learning across civil society and research organizations. Including your own, I'm sure, including Cuba9, to help bridge some of these gaps and really catalyze this moment that you spoke of like being ready to act. Build the relationship has been built and nurtured, and now is the time for some diplomatic momentum for quite practical cooperation. So I think just to wrap up this fascinating conversation, just to really drill down on the practical paths forward, what would your message be to policymakers about the urgency behind this and therefore the opportunity for diplomatic cooperation or just trilateral collaboration we've been speaking about around climate, peace, and security in the Indo-Pacific. And we don't need to use this framing if it doesn't resonate with India, but engaging on these issues.
I've been thinking a lot about this question, but I would say in a as diplomatic fashion as I could is that we need to be a little bit more bold in how we think and how we move forward in some ways. I would say that we need some more bold, fresh, and I feel like I use this word too much, but more innovative thinking is required. And it's not that we need to say, oh, somebody come up with an idea. A lot of bold, innovative ideas exist. What we need to do, or rather, what our policymakers and our politicians and our bureaucrats need to do, is realize the value of having a more like interconnected, integrated, interdisciplinary approach. And so, while India as a country might not very much like this framing of climate, peace, and security, it is an important framing. We can call it whatever we want, but it is climate, it is about peace, and it is about security, right? Now we don't have to think of security only as a more traditional form of how we on how security has been framed for the last so many decades. We can reframe what security means in the CPS dialogue. Change that and then go forward. We are, I think, too hesitant to do these things. And so we are then not able to think a little bit more forward-leaning in that sense, with a future-forward idea of how we want, human and environment security to actually look like. So we're saying climate and renewables, climate and critical minerals, and climate is also about like agriculture, it's also about heat now. And then we are saying security is about like our borders and long-term like defense. But these are not separate issues. In many ways they intersect, right? And ultimately then that becomes about your peace of your nation, maybe your region if you are interested in that, and then the globe again if that's the kind of power you want to be. And so if India wants to be this great global power, which it has these ambitions, then you have to have bold steps to reach that ambition, and then you have to work with a multitude of people, and so, and that means a multitude of partners. And I would say then have that thinking also has to be pretty wide ranging, and that's where we are lacking a little bit. Yeah. So it's not a terribly like new message. I know lots of people have this message, but I feel like one of these, it's one of those points that hopefully if we say it more, again and again and in different contexts and in different spaces, it will make a difference then.
Wonderful. So, thank you, Ambika. Thank you so much for sharing your insights, your expertise, with us today. I think this is a really important conversation. So often, we have conversations about climate, peace, and security, and India is not part of this conversation, India or South Asia. And as you've really emphasized so articulately, we can't think about effective solutions and effective collaboration without thinking about the very constructive and important role that India can play. And I think it's really core, as you've left us with this message, to understand these intersections of climate, peace, and security and geopolitics, not just as challenges, but these are the spaces for collaboration. These are the spaces for climate diplomacy. So really, really grateful to you for your time. Thank you for joining us, and thank you to the audience for joining this global conversation.